Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Normally, I would never lead a show with the announcement of the order of something that's going to take place in more than a month. Doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense. That'd be like Aaron Boone announcing the Yankees batting lineup for their June 20th, 7:05 p.m. game against Houston, and then expecting me to lead the show with it. Except most announcements of draft order do not have the kind of drama that we had last night. In fact, none of them do. Why is that? First, the stakes. The stakes were incredibly high. You get the number one pick, and you get a chance to draft a generational, transcendent player in Zion Williamson. Number two, the location. That was different. As was pointed out on Twitter, the draft lottery was being held in the Hilton Chicago, the same hotel where Harrison Ford confronted the evil scientist in The Fugitive. In other words, the drama was thick, really thick last night. And the first sign that it was going to get nuts was when the 11th pick was revealed, and it was not the LA Lakers, meaning LA had jumped up. And then it got a little more intense when the 9th pick was the Wizards, which meant that Memphis and New Orleans had jumped up. In other words, I had not seen people tripping like that in the Chicago Hilton since Dr. Richard Kimball told everybody that the samples had been switched.
Devlin McGregor could give you Provasic.
Right. At this point, the drama was building. And then came even more action when Deputy Commissioner Mark Tatum revealed that the 5th pick in the draft was going to Cleveland, which meant that the Knicks were in the top four. So, four teams were left for that final pick. The Pelicans, the Grizz, the Knicks, the Lakers. The two biggest markets in the final four. Zion having a chance to go to one of the two most historic franchises. Man, that thing could not be setting up any better than it was. And the Lakers. Could the Lakers who puked all over themselves for the past 5 weeks, could they still end up with Zion? Or could the Knicks get Zion and either keep him or deal him to get Anthony Davis and get a new big three all in one summer? So obviously at this point, when you're in the top four, you want your name not to be called. You want to wait as long as you possibly can before you hear your name. So now is the time to go to the reactions. And here's the thing. I could do an entire program on just reaction videos from Knicks fans, but I won't. Because most of them are either fake or pathetic or both. Just like I could spend time on that one dope who got a Zion Knicks tattoo before the draft. But I won't do that because that guy just wants to get run and attention. And I'm not here for that. But I am here for this. Here is the reaction from one group of Knicks fans when it was announced that the Cavs got the 5th pick. If you're watching that on CBS Sports Network, you can see it. The Knicks in the top four. The Knicks in the top four. The dream is alive. Hashtag Knicks tape is back. And then the Lakers are revealed as the number four pick, and it is on. The big dog coming to New York. That's what that meant. Knicks fans are partying like crazy for about 2 seconds before the third pick is announced.
The fourth pick in the 2019 NBA draft goes to the Los Angeles.
Did you follow that? And that was a little bit confusing. So the Lakers are revealed as the fourth pick. Knicks fans are freaking out. Hey, LA, tell me how my ass tastes. You know, talk all the junk you want about stacking your championships and us having to fly our Billy Joel banner in MSG and celebrating not great basketball, but dopes who drive into houses. But we're getting the number one. Look at us. Hey, Laker fan, tell me how my... No! It all went down like in 3 seconds. I mean, damn, that was cold. That was cold. Honestly, it was hilarious. Knicks fans, euphoric, enjoying the best day of their lives for like 3 seconds before it got ripped right from them. Didn't even get a commercial break to bask in the glow and to keep on freshening up their photoshops of Zion in a Knicks jersey. I have never seen cheers turn to F-bombs as quickly as they did. And then the ultimate reveal and the ultimate party. When it was official that New Orleans was getting the number one pick, the Pelicans ticket office lost its collective bleep.
Grizzlies.
That sounds good, but that looks even better. Video, that's great. That's fun. I haven't seen that many people in shirts and ties freak out like that since the Dow Jones cracked 26 gur. And that reaction was almost as good as my man Alvin Gentry back in the actual room where the actual drawing took place.
New Orleans.
Congratulations to New Orleans for winning the first pick in the 2019 NBA lottery.
My man dropping F-bombs and high-fiving execs from other teams who just lost. Alvin Gentry, that was awesome. And then there's the tie. There's more to this. There was the tie that Gentry was wearing. It was the same black and silver tie that Jeff Cohen, former member of the Cavs organization, had worn to the lottery when the Cavaliers had won 3 lotteries earlier in the decade. And of course, there is a story behind that too.
You got it. And
yeah, so Jeff Cohen, who was with us in Cleveland, had worn that tie for all 3 of his wins. And I called him and I said, hey, I need a little help. And he said, Griff, there's no such thing as a lucky totem. There is nothing like that. If you see it, you can believe it. You don't need anything like a lucky rabbit's foot or anything like that. And I said, yeah, okay, can I have the tie? So he sent us the tie. So that's where that came from.
And look who got the first pick. The Pelicans just turned the 7th best odds into Zion. And that throws everything up in the air. The result was pretty much the only scenario in which the Lakers could get a top 4 pick and still have a worse chance of trading for Anthony Davis. And not only did the Knicks not get Zion, who they were going to flip to get AD, but now their pick probably is not good enough to get AD either. So could Zion coming mean that Anthony Davis might actually stick it out in New Orleans? Or have those bridges already been torched? And if that is the case, who can give New Orleans the best package of players and picks to pair with Zion? You see, this is why my man Dell Demps and the Pelicans were smart not to trade Davis before the trade deadline, because you wanted to wait to find out which team would get the Zion pick. And as it turns out, they were the team that got the Zion pick. So now it is officially on. And one more thought about the Lakers. Generally, you get exactly what you deserve. But given how bad they've been, given how many bad decisions that they have made, given how jacked up their organization is right now, the Lakers really did not deserve to bump into the good fortune that they bumped into last night. So now they've got themselves a pretty good chip. Again, the way that thing played out, they might actually be in a worse spot to trade for Anthony Davis, but they do have themselves an asset. The Lakers have themselves a chip. Here's hoping Linda and Kurt Rambis don't just give that chip away or lose it or give it to Cedric Ceballos to hold on to for them or Sadeo 3. Jason Terry is my guest. Jet, it's been a minute or two. What's up? How are you?
Oh, all's well, man. You're too kind with your words, man. I appreciate you.
Great talking to you. I appreciate you too, Jason. Good to have you back. Listen, there are a lot of different things that you and I could talk about, but why don't we start with the Warriors and more specifically the University of Arizona's influence on them. You've got Steve Kerr. You've got Andre Iguodala. You've got Bruce Frazier all repping the Wildcats. It can't be a coincidence, right? Like, how much of that success has its roots in Arizona?
Oh, a lot of that success have to do with the roots from Arizona and Steve Kerr and the way he's implemented the style of play and the culture the winning championship culture which has been created. I mean, if you look at Steve Kerr's career, started out in Arizona and then on as an NBA champion with the Chicago Bulls and the San Antonio Spurs, he has the championship pedigree, and he's infused that into this organization and into his star players. I mean, Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, Draymond Green, even KD, as he's become a Golden State Warrior. And they've created this tremendous legacy, a dynasty even, within that organization. And just great to see, and I knew it would happen. I mean, you know, Steve Kerr is a high-character individual. His story speaks volumes, and he's the type of coach that you love to play for.
Contractors can rely on Ferguson to provide a winning game plan for any job, any day. Thanks to their pro pickup service, you can choose from thousands of products to order online and pick up in-store, which makes doing business with Ferguson the easiest part of your day. Jason Terry is joining us on the program. All right, so let me move you ahead to the Bucks, because the Bucks are about to host game one of the Eastern Conference Finals against the Raptors. You were with Milwaukee last year and the year before that, so did you see this coming?
Yes, I definitely seen it coming, and you have to give a lot of credit to Jason Kidd and that staff. I was there 2 years. Jason was there four, and this is kind of what he envisioned. I mean, he laid the foundation for these guys to have success. And if you look directly at the growth and development of Giannis, it was a day-to-day grind. I mean, I watched them develop Giannis from the film room to the weight room to the on-court, just developing his all-around game. And, you know, he's taken flight. And you give, you know, the new staff a lot of credit. You give management, John Horst, give him credit. This is just a total team project, even ownership. You know, putting the right personnel around Giannis now this season, you know, with shooters, Brooke Lopez, Chris Middleton, Ilyasova, all these guys, even the veteran George Hill, have all played an incremental part of the success this season. But the foundation was laid with Jason Kidd and his staff when you're talking about the development of Giannis and the rest of those guys.
The Jet, Jason Terry joins us. You know, you've told this great story about being in practice with him and seeing Giannis on a fast break, and he takes off from behind the free throw line and he throws it down. What's it like to see a guy that big do something like that?
Oh, it freaked me out, literally, and I hate to use that word, but, you know, he is the Greek freak, and this was a daily regimen of his. I mean, one thing about Giannis is he's a fierce competitor, and he wanted to win every single drill. And actually, the time he took off from the free throw line, he was really pissed off because two plays previously, Jabari Parker had dunked on him and kind of embarrassed him a little bit. And so he was pissed, man. He stole the ball and just took off. And about two steps after half court, he just took flight. And everybody's looking like, he's not. And it was just one of the greatest plays I've ever seen in sport up close and personal.
And it was in practice. Jason Terry is joining us. You know, this season marked the end of Dirk's career, and I'm moving ahead a little bit, but you played with Dirk for 8 seasons. So when you think of Dirk, what are the things you think of first? What kind of memories do you have of him?
Well, just thinking about all the hours and nights that he spent in the gym to amass the amount of success that he did individually and team-wise with that organization. I mean, I was there for 8 seasons alongside Dirk. I was brought in originally to replace Steve Nash, but Dirk wasn't warmed up to that originally because he and Nash had a tremendous bond, and rightfully so. But as we went through it, as we went through some adversities, had some failure, and then gained success, we grown to have a great relationship. My locker was by his for 8 years, man, and just to be able to watch him develop into not only the person he is, the player, but the family man that he's become, is just an honor. It's an honor to have played alongside him and to know him and to be able to call him a friend, and then to watch the legacy that he's left behind, and to watch a guy like Luka Doncic be able to come in now with playing with Dirk in his rookie season and be able to see that process take place. I mean, Dirk left the game in a better place when he left. And that's what you want all your NBA superstars to do, you know, leave the game in a better place. And he was able to do so.
Jason Terry joining us for a few more moments. Now, you're going to be a captain in the Big Three League this year. How much are you looking forward to that?
Oh, I'm excited, man. Obviously, my career ended abruptly, you know, at the age 41. I thought I still had something left in it. in the tank and still do, but being able to go out in the big three now in a league that Ice Cube created with guys that I either played with or played against but call my brothers is going to be phenomenal. And to be able to do it in some cities where there were NBA teams and NBA fans in, that are fans of me, you know, fans of the Jet. You know, all that moniker that I created throughout my playing career, to be able to get one kind of last hurrah, to go out on my own, to put on a show and have fun doing. But as you know, I've won at every level, and I don't see anything different in the big three. I'm trying to bring the championship home.
I like it. And one more thing, Jet, you're also giving back. For years, you've been really involved in youth basketball, and you're the co-president of Lady Drive Nation. Lay that out for me. Exactly what is that all about, and how fired up are you for that?
Oh, I'm excited. Again, this is just a situation in the community that I've been a part of with my own foundation for 12 years in Dallas. My off season are dedicated to the young women in the Dallas, Texas community, and it gives them a platform to be able to go out and showcase their talents across the nation in front of tons of Division I, II, III college scouts. I have 100% graduation rate over those 12 years. All my kids go academically or athletically on scholarship to the next level. A lot of these kids are less fortunate. They would not be able to have that opportunity had it not been for a program like myself. So I'm very happy this year to join forces with Jermaine O'Neal, who also played a long time in the NBA, at Drive Nation. It's his baby. He runs the boys' side. I run the girls' side. And we give all these kids hope at obtaining their dream.
He is an NBA champion, an NCAA champion. He played 19 years in the NBA, 2009, sixth man of the year, the Jet, Jason Terry. Jet, like I said, it's been a minute or two. Great to get caught up with you, man. Great to have you back. Let's make sure we do it again soon.
Anytime. Talk to you soon.
I'm not here to pat myself on the back, but you know I'm a pro, right? A pro at keeping you clones in line. A pro at interviewing the right people in sports. So, because I am that, I've got some simple advice that can help you all out. When you're looking for pro tips on vehicle maintenance or repair, look no further than O'Reilly Auto Parts. Whether it comes to replacing your battery, getting advice on proper car maintenance, or even just getting the best bang for your buck, their expert team can help you out every step of the way. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices every day. Moving on to the Western Conference Finals. For a minute, the Rocket series, there was this whole thing, this narrative about Steph Curry. The narrative being that the Warriors were Kevin Durant's team, not Steph's. And that the Warriors, without Kevin Durant, were suddenly vulnerable. Maybe even beatable. Like all of a sudden they were not the team to beat. The narrative also included the suggestion that Steph was struggling in the playoffs and that Steph certainly was not the player he used to be. Never mind that he was playing with a jack digit that you know is bothering him more than he was letting on. Then he was held scoreless in the first half of Game 6, and the haters were out in full force. Never mind that this guy is a two-time MVP with a fistful of jewelry. The Dubs were in trouble. Steph was scoreless, and folks were rushing in to bury this guy. Yet right up until he scored 33 in the second half, including 23 in the fourth quarter, and single-handedly closed out the Rockets and ruined them. The Rockets were dead, and that narrative about Steph should have been as well. But for some reason, it wasn't. Especially for those dopes who look at this guy and never respected him the way they should have in the first place. Well, if you still had some questions, they were answered last night. 36 points, 9 threes, en route to a 116-94 beatdown in Game 1. My man had it all working. Back-to-back threes to end the first half.
48-45 Warriors. Steph Curry off the screen. Nails a three. Gets it right back. Just like that.
Stop, aim, fire.
McCollum defending. Looney screening. Steph comes middle. Steph turns. Fires away. Three ball. Good. He didn't even handle it cleanly.
Warriors radio. There were those. And then there was this absurd fast break three.
Iguodala's got it. It's a three on three. Steph Curry stops and pops. Left wing triple. Good for Steph.
And on top of that, there was this.
Steph off a screen. Takes a three straight on. Knocked out another one. His eighth three of the night. Curry's got 31.
Man, that looked easy. That looked really easy. You know why that looked easy? Because it was easy. Golden State was rested. They were ready. The Blazers, though, were gassed. They played Game 7 on Sunday. Then they had to face the most dominant team of this era, and they had to do so on the road on short rest. No wonder Dame and CJ had off nights. Listen, that was not a matter of will. That was not a matter of the moment being too big for them, or the stage being too big, or a lack of preparation, or a lack of focus, or a lack of heart. All that garbage was floating around last night. I actually heard things like that. It's ridiculous. You think for a second that Damian Lillard, playing in the conference finals in his hometown of Oakland, is going to be overawed by that moment. You think that Damian Lillard is going to shrink from that. You think CJ McCollum, coming off a 37-point performance in Game 7 in Denver, is going to feel like the conference finals are too big for him. Man, shut the hell up with that. That's not what that is. What that is a matter of them having nothing left in the tank for Game 1. That's a matter of them running into a team that had been rested. And yes, there is going to be an issue with Portland and how they defend Steph Curry. He had a lot of open looks, and a lot of that was a result of Enes Kanter not picking him up on screen actions. And they're going to have to figure that out. If not, he will destroy them like he did last night. But even as exhausted as Portland looked, and as poorly as Lillard and McCollum shot it, they were still within reach at the end of the third quarter. There's just not an easy solution when you play Golden State. That's why they're Golden State. Even without Kevin Durant, they're still monsters. And they move the ball so well, especially without Durant. I mean, I would never argue that they're better without Durant, but the ball does move a lot better without Durant. Not even a rap on Kevin Durant. You throw the ball into him, the ball probably should stop moving. The guy can get whatever he wants, whenever he wants, against whomever he wants. That's why the ball stops moving. Except when he's not in there, the ball does move. And then they're in their rhythm, and they're in their flow, and they can go deep. Like 13 guys deep. And that's a nightmare for Portland. Because it's not just Klay that got off, or Curry. I mean, it's that. It's things were going so well that even Klay got up and dunked.
Hood goes to Harkless in the corner. It's a three. Blocked by Draymond. Grabbed by Curry. Klay Thompson breakaway. Dunk!
If Klay's going to throw one down, that's a problem. But that's not the biggest problem. No, it's the guys that were fresh going into the game and fresh coming out of it. Golden State played 13 guys. 10 of them went for 10 minutes or more. So the fresh get fresher, and suddenly that lack of warrior depth that was supposed to be the thing that was going to break them may not be an issue. Not if they're getting quality minutes off the bench like they did last night. And that's going to be a problem for Portland, especially since Steph is still Steph, no matter how badly the haters want to say he's not. So yes, Portland is in deep. But they've been in deep before. And not because they're just happy to be here or because the stage is too big. And they're in deep because they were gassed going to last night's game. But anybody who thinks that one's over after one game, I mean, who are you, Paul Pierce? Anybody stupid enough to say that a series is over after just one game? This one definitely is not over.
No, listen, I think it's over.
Well, you're right, it was over. Except the other team won. This one's not over. They are in deep, but they have been in deep before. And they're really bad takes. They're bad takes like, oh, man, this series is over. Boston won game one. This series is over. That's a bad take. Steph Curry, not being what he was, not being trustworthy in the postseason, another really bad take.
I think it's over.
Pierre McGuire. Pierre, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Jim, how are you?
Pierre, I'm great. Let me be more specific. I start every conversation with you like this time of year, but where are you at this very moment, and how is life on the road treating you?
Life on the road is treating me great, so I'll take the second part first. I'm in St. Louis, Missouri, getting ready for Game 3 of San Jose and St. Louis, which I think, Jim, is going to have a very long life span to this series, very long.
Pierre, let's talk about the other series because that may not have as long of a lifespan. Now, you've got San Jose, St. Louis tonight, but You've got Boston beating Carolina 2-1 last night. They take a 3-0 lead in the Eastern Conference Final. It's a team, Pierre, that was down 3-2 against Toronto in the first round. Now they're on the verge of winning the conference. How do you explain the run that they're on right now?
There's a lot of different ways to look at it. Tuukka Rask has been exceptional in goal. That's number one. Number two, total commitment to team defense. They've been phenomenal. Lines 1 through 4 up front and all three pairings on defense have really been committed to team defense. Number three, offense from depth players. Phenomenal contribution from their depth players, whether it be on defense or up front in terms of manufacturing offense. And their penalty killing has been phenomenal. So you put it all together. They're a team that can play a four-line attack-oriented type game. Their defense is really structured and stable. Their goaltending is phenomenal. They've got a coaching staff that's as deep and as good as anybody else's in the league, and they're legitimately big-time good as a group.
Pierre McGuire joining us. All right, so let me stay on the goaltending for a minute. Rask has got a .944 save percentage against Carolina. He stopped 20 shots, Pierre, in the first period alone. If you're the Hurricanes and you're down 2-0 and you come back and you put 20 shots on goal in the first period and have nothing to show for it, how frustrating is that?
Yeah, they were broken. You could see it at the start of the second period because the second period was nothing like the first. They threw everything they could at Tuukka Rask, and they couldn't score. Plus, they had a 5-on-3 power play advantage, and they couldn't score on that either. So that's a problem. And then you saw what happened. The Bruins get a goal from their fourth line. Chris Wagner out of Colgate University scores to make it 1-0, and then Brad Marchand scores on the power play to make it 2-0, and it's basically game over. That's a problem, Jim. And so you know what it's like. They basically got broken, and you saw some uncharacteristic things happen with their group after they did go down 2-0. And this is what happens in a series when you've got one team that's really deep and another team that's not as deep, and they've had to max out every single series they've played. And Carolina should be so proud. Their team has maxed out every single night. But I think now they've run into the wall. There's nowhere for them to go. I really don't think there is.
Pierre McGuire, my guest. Speaking of that depth, Pierre, when you've got the Bruins' fourth line showing up the way it does, you know they're deep. Now, when you look at success in the postseason, especially when a fourth line is rolling like that, how much of that is about analytics, and then how much of that is about character and a team that bonds and understands each other?
It has nothing to do with analytics. It has to do everything with heart, soul, desire, coachability, belief in one another, and the coach presenting a plan to the players and the players accepting the plan. That's what the depth players do. I go back to the 2010 Stanley Cup win by the Bruins. Their best line in Game 7 in Vancouver was their fourth line. Danny Pyatt, Gregory Campbell, Sean Thornton. Those guys had some of the worst analytic numbers in the National Hockey League. So analytics has nothing to do with it. It has to do with heart, soul, courage, coachability, commitment, and following the coach's plan. And that's what the Bruins guys have done so well. And they've done it all season long, Jim, not just in the first round or second round or now in the third round. They've done it all season long. That fourth line has been such a weapon for Bruce Cassidy and his coaching staff in Boston.
Pierre McGuire joining us. All right, so you're in St. Louis right now. Pierre, how hungry is that city and that fan base for a Stanley Cup? What's it like there?
They're ravenous. They want it so bad, Jim. It's unbelievable. It's an exciting place to be. You know, I had a chance to do all 7 of their games with Dallas in Game 7, the explosion after they won in double overtime on the Patrick Maroon. A St. Louis native was scoring the series-winning goal in double overtime. It was phenomenal. It was off the charts, Jim. It's a great place to be right now for hockey. Just like I have to tell you, San Jose is just as intense, just as ravenous as it is in St. Louis, and that's why I think this series has a lot of legs left to it. But no, these people are just crying out to go to the Stanley Cup, their final. They just want it so bad, Jim. It's unbelievable.
Great series, tough series, tied up at a game apiece. Game 3 coming up. And Pierre, the Blues changed up their defensive partnerships in Game 2. What was the thinking behind those moves, and how significant were they?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. It's something we brought up on the broadcast, and it was a significant part of the game. In the first period, they had a real difficult time, Jim, breaking down the San Jose forecheck. And so Mike Van Ryan, who's a brilliant young assistant coach, I just finished talking to him at practice, Jim, just he basically said we needed to shake it up. We needed to get more puck movement and less stopping. And so what they did was they changed up the partnerships, and it worked fantastically well. The last 40 minutes of that game, they did a much better job of not turning the puck over and getting the puck out of their own zone. Now, I think they're going to go back to their original partnerships to start this game, but they won't be afraid to change them up if they have to. But it was a significant moment, Jim, in Game 2 when they decided to break up all three tandems on the back end.
All right, so what about San Jose? What do the Sharks have to do, Pierre, tonight to get back on track?
get their forecheck game going. And the biggest thing when they're going, and I did all seven of their games with Colorado in the last round as well, when they're going, they cycle the net of the opposition as well or better than any team in the NHL that I've seen this year. And so that's what they need to get back to. Use the net as a reference point to start creating your offense. And if they do that, I think they're going to have a little bit more success. For whatever reason, they were keeping a lot of things to the outside in game two. And that's not their game. Their game is a power game. They're big people, Jim. They've got people up front. They got a lot of skill. They've got a lot of speed. But they need to start getting back to the grinding and the bumping and the ground and pound, as I like to call it. So I think that's one of the things they really need to focus in on.
So you touched on that, Pierre. But bottom line, who is winning the physical battle right now?
I'd say it's 50-50. I can't, because the series is 1-1, Jim. I'd say in game one, San Jose won the physical battle. I'd say in game two, St. Louis won the physical battle. So I'd say it's probably 50-50. But that's why I brought up the point on San Jose. They've got to get back to their identity of grounding and pounding and getting it in behind the opposition goal and really going to work.
Pierre McGuire, my guest. You know, Pierre, we could talk about these matchups. I've got to ask you about the run you're on right now, because there was a stretch earlier in the postseason where you worked 26 of 30 days, but 15 straight where you never had consecutive games in the same city. I understand that you love hockey as much as anybody on the planet, but how do you manage to keep your energy up and stay fresh?
I go to the Jim Rome School of Broadcasting. Intensity, man. No, I go to the gym a lot, Jim. I really do, no pun intended. I eat a lot of green vegetables. I can sleep on planes, and I have a really good pregame meal. How's that?
I think that's good. I like that a lot, but I'm telling you, I could do an entire interview, Pierre, on your process during the postseason. I really am fascinated by this. As an example, you do try to eat as cleanly as you possibly can. I know you hit the gym as often as you possibly can, no pun intended. Why are those things so important, and how tough is that to do that when you're on the road? Because we all know it is really tough to eat well and train consistently when you travel a lot.
No, it really is. I think just the biggest thing is to flush the plane rides out of me anyways. That's one of the things I try to do, and it gives me a chance to get away from the phone, to get away from just the outside noise. It always surrounds a series or surrounds a game. And so when I'm working out, I just put my tunes on, and I get on the bike or I get on the treadmill, and I crank it out and do a lot of isometric exercise and, you know, come up, take a hot shower, and get to the rink and have some fun with it.
Pierre McGuire joining us. All right, speaking of getting to the rink, Pierre, you're known for showing up 3.5 to 4 hours before games. I also want to know, why is that important? As an example, if I come in, and I've learned to do this, but I've always tried to come in well before the program, but if you go that hard before the program, you have to make sure you save something for the program. So why is it important to you to get to the rink that early?
I like to talk to the trainers when the players aren't around. I like to talk to the assistant coaches at breakdown tape, because that's what I used to do. I like to talk to the security guards that are in the rink that come in and just say thank you for everything they do. So I do it for both teams. I do it in every rink. I just like to be – Jim, I guess I'm a rink rat. I guess that's the best way to describe it. I've always been that way, even when I was playing or when I was coaching. You know, when I was coaching in Hartford, I used to sleep in my office. So I know that's probably not the most healthy thing to do, but I used to do it just because I didn't want anything to slip. And I think that's, but I've always enjoyed being at the rink. But the biggest thing, I just enjoy the people around the game and being at the rink with them. And I don't feel like I burn out. I just feel like I get more and more information. And one of the men that I worked with early in my career, the great late Badger Bob Johnson, he said, try to learn something new every day that you go to the rink, and you'll have a real good career. So I took him at his word starting in 1990. And every time I go to the rink, I try to learn something new.
Pierre McGuire joining us. You know, it takes me back, Pierre. I remember back in the 90s, early 2000s. I mean, this is a great time to talk hockey. I was in Wisconsin actually last week, and I saw Tony Granato, one of my favorites. And college hockey is a blast, isn't it? I love college hockey. Do you spend much time with the college game?
I do. In fact, I had the privilege of Johnson's Lady Badgers team before they went to the NCAA tournament. The weekend they played Syracuse, and then the weekend that they went to Connecticut and won the Frozen Four. So that was in Wisconsin, and I actually visited with Tony and some of his people, his staff, Jim Schneider, their strength and conditioning coach. The week I was out there, my son was drafted by the Madison Capitals in the USHL, so he was actually out there playing, so I had a chance to sneak in and watch some of his games. So it was kind of neat. But, yeah, no, I do a lot of college hockey. I watch a lot of Harvard. I watch a lot of BU. I watch a lot of BC. I coached at St. Lawrence for a long time and had some success there. So I'm a big college hockey fan. I watch a ton of it.
No one loves the sport more. Pierre McGuire, an NBC hockey analyst, a scout and assistant with the Penguins and part of that organization's back-to-back Stanley Cups, a Sports Emmy Award winner, and remember, recently named as a member of the Hockey Hall of Fame Selection Committee, and that was last year. Pierre, thanks for making time for this show like you always do, and it's great to talk some hockey with you.
It is awesome to be in the jungle with you, Jim. Thanks so much for having me. You have no idea how much your support means for hockey. We all appreciate it so much, Jim. Thanks.
I want to talk to you about my personal experience with Johnny O and the Johnny O tweener button. Johnny O invented and patented the tweener button. What this is the hidden button between the second and third button, and it's featured on all of Johnny O's shirts. It is the first patented button to make sure that you're not too buttoned up and not too unbuttoned. Now, why is it so great? Because it solves the age-old second button dilemma. We all deal with this. Do you button one or do you button two? That's not a dilemma any longer. My man Johnny O figured this whole thing out. And every Johnny O shirt comes with a patented tweener button, so you're always going to look just right. It is a total game changer. Right now, you can use the promo code ROME and get 20% off your first order at johnny-o.com. That's at checkout through May 30th. 20% off the regular price button-ups, which come in a range of fabrics, patterns, and styles. And shipping is free for orders over $85. That's johnny-o.com. Promo code ROME and get 20% off that first order. Free shipping on orders over $85. Go to johnny-o.com for your tweener shirt. 20% off, and then check out the wide selection of shirts and other products ranging from polos to shorts to pants to swim and more. johnny-o.com. So game one of the Eastern Conference Finals gets underway tonight in Milwaukee. Raptors and Bucks. Kawhi v. Giannis. Claw v. Freak, and another incredible edition of Rest v. Rust. The Raptors coming off a Game 7 win on Sunday. The Bucks have been idle for a week, so is that too much time off at this point of year, or is that a good thing or a bad thing? We're going to find out tonight. This much we know. It's the two best teams in the Eastern Conference all season long, and they're going to meet in the conference finals. The Bucks were the best defensive team in the regular season, and they've been even better in the playoffs. Same time, Kawhi and company will be the best offensive team that Milwaukee has seen in the postseason. So, the big question, how does Toronto go about defending Giannis? Kawhi was not matched up on him that often in the regular season, so do you put him on the Freak right now? Or do you stick with Pascal Siakam? And then what do you do with Marc Gasol and Serge Ibaka? And then on the other end, how is Chris Middleton going to do against Kawhi defensively? And can the Bucks force Kawhi into being a playmaker and get the ball out of his hands? I mean, there's so many different angles to this series. It's a great, great matchup. So how do you break it down? How do you break it down, and what does this series come down to? Well, if you put that question to Giannis, he says it's actually pretty simple.
You know, against Boston, you can go down 1-0 and you still be fine. But against Toronto, you know, it's hard to be in that spot. You know, we lose the first game in your home.
Oh! Boom! Roasted! Damn, Giannis! Stop, Giannis! The Celtics are already dead. Giannis, you already just said, quote, against Boston, you can go down 1-0 and still be fine. Run that back for me.
You know, against Boston, you can go down 1-0 and you still be fine, but...
Oh! Open wound meets salt. Salt, here's the open wound. Man, there was no intimidation whatsoever. Absolutely no intimidation factor there. Lose game one at home and, quote, we'll still be fine. It's amazing. Yeah, we'll spot you a game and we'll still win in five. How's that taste, Boston? It's been a week since Giannis slammed the door on you and he's still dunking on your head. Viciously throwing down and hanging on the rim for like an hour after he did it. He ended your season last week. He's still killing you this week. And of course, everybody went nuts over that. Except for one problem. He's not wrong. And he didn't do that to disrespect the Celtics. The worst part of that is that it's a matter of fact. He didn't go into some like big old windup and deliver some cartoon style haymaker. He's just telling the truth. He's just being real. He's just spitting facts. It's a statement of fact. Against Boston, the Bucks did go down 1-0. Not only did they go down 1-0, they lost game one at home by 22. And he's right, they were fine because they won the next four. They made a couple of adjustments. They dominated from that point on. It was easy. Giannis is right. The Celtics are a card house, but the Raptors are not the kind of team that's just going to fold like that. They were down 2-1 in their series against Philadelphia, and they had been blown out in game three. But they didn't quit. They didn't fold. Their star player did not start saying asinine stuff about needing more shots. They dug in. They went to work. They found a way to win. Like the Raptors, they may not be as talented as Boston on paper, but they're a much better team. They have legit leadership. They have a star that puts the team on his back, and they keep grinding, and they keep battling. The Celtics, yeah, not so much. When the going got tough, Kyrie quit. He looked for the nearest exit, and he just disappeared. When his shot wasn't working, his defense stopped, and then he just stopped altogether. It's a miracle that Kyrie stayed on the floor for the entire Game 5 and didn't just throw his jersey into the crowd and disappear down the tunnel in the middle of the fourth quarter. You think that's going to happen with Kawhi? Hell no. First off, Kawhi's defense never stops. Secondly, he and his guys are too mentally tough to pack it in and fold like that. They're still in for a challenge against a Bucks team that has already skipped a ton of steps this year. But unlike the Celtics, they're not going to see that challenge and then just look for a nice soft place to lay down and die. Because the Raptors are everything that the Celtics are not. And Giannis was 100% accurate in what he said.
You know, against Boston, you can go down 1-0 and you still be fine.
Why are people freaking out about that? He's right. They did go down 1-0 and they were fine.
Someone call someone.
As you probably have gathered, it takes more than just hard work to make it to the pros. It takes smarts. You know, the kind of smarts that can read a defense and pick it apart. Well, hiring is no different. You need smarts to find the right people, but you don't need to spend years honing your game. You only need ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes to find the right people with the right experience and then invites them to apply for your job. Try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/clones. That's ZipRecruiter.com/CLONES. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Morgan Burnett is my guest. Morgan, always good to have you on the show. How are you?
I'm doing good. How you doing?
Good, good. Listen, take me back to April, if you don't mind. You were a free agent. There were a number of places where you could have gone, but you signed with Cleveland pretty quickly. What was it about the Browns and that opportunity that had you so excited?
Of course, it was just familiar faces, you know, that I was used to working with in Green Bay. But just, you know, you just see all the talent that they have, and you knew the, you know, the excitement coming around, and just to have that opportunity to sign a guy like myself going into my 10th year, man, I was very excited about it. And like I said, it was a smooth transition for me, especially being able to have worked with some of the guys that's here back when I was in Green Bay. So it just felt like family, felt like home.
Morgan Burnett joining us. You know, one of the guys you mentioned, a face that you knew from Green Bay, GM John Dorsey. And he was with the Packers back in 2010 when they drafted you out of Georgia Tech. So what's it like to reunite with him, and what do you make of the roster that he has assembled in Cleveland?
I mean, it's very exciting. Like you said, you know, he's part of the reason that the reason why I got in the league. You know, they took a chance on a kid out of Georgia Tech. And, you know, I'm thankful that everything worked out for me for my career and going into my 10th year. So, like I said, I'm excited. You know, I'm just thankful to get the opportunity. And just coming into the locker room, you know, those guys welcome me with open arms. And just the players in the locker room, they have a great camaraderie. It's a lot of fun on the practice field, the high level of competition. So, you know, we're all about making each other better, and that's what I look forward to.
Morgan Burnett joining us. He's now a member of the Browns. You know, it seems like from the outside, there's a ton of potential with the Browns, but obviously you know a lot better than me. When you look around and you see the guys at the facility that you see, does it strike you as a team that can not only compete for a playoff spot, but maybe make some noise once it gets there?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you coming in, you got to have that spirit and that atmosphere. And I mean, if you don't have that mentality, then you're in the wrong business. So walking in every day, you just feel that energy, just the energy in the locker room, the way the guys gel together, but also the way the guys demand and compete with one another. So I think that's the most important thing, just the things that go on the practice field, the way the guys compete. You know, right now, it's really early. I'm pretty sure all 32 teams have the same mentality right now, but our main focus is just keep having that arrow, keep going up, and not try to get ahead of ourselves and taking it one day at a time.
Now, your new head coach, Freddie Kitchens, called you, quote, the definition of a leader, end quote. And leadership is something you and I have talked about a lot over the years. You know, it seems to me that's really high praise coming from a head coach for a guy coming in like yourself, and especially in a room with so many alphas. What's that mean to you to hear your head coach speak of you like that? And then how do you go about trying to apply that leadership to a new situation?
Oh, that really means a lot. You know, you appreciate that, and that's something that you don't take lightly. Like you said, that's a great compliment for someone to acknowledge someone as a leader. But my main thing is just, I was always taught from my dad, just, you know, stay true to yourself, you know, be who you are, and just lead the way that I know how to lead, and not try to be someone else or not try to compare myself to anyone else, but just be Morgan Burnett and try to help out the best way I can in any way that I can for this football team.
Morgan Burnett is joining us. Now, I've had Kitchens on this show. Man, I could not be more impressed with him. What are your early impressions of the coach and the rest of his coaching staff?
Oh, man, it's awesome. You can tell that, you know, they're really players' coach, and they're going to do anything that's needed from a coach's standpoint to help and provide us players with the tools we need to go out and be successful. I mean, those guys are very knowledgeable of the game. And like I said, they make it a fun atmosphere to where you enjoy coming in to work, but you know you're going to come in, you know that you're going to get better, and you know that you're going to come in ready to compete. And that's what you respect out of our coaches here.
You know, looking defensively, well, you got talent on both sides of the ball, of course. And on defense, you're arriving this offseason with guys like Olivier Vernon, Sheldon Richardson. How valuable, then, is it to have that kind of experience? And then what kinds of things are you looking to teach some of the younger guys?
I mean, that's very valuable. Like you said, those guys have a long resume for themselves, and they bring their leadership aspect. And that's the great thing I like about this team. It's not just one guy you're depending on for leadership. You got leaders all over the roster. So that's very exciting. And they bring a lot to the table. And then for young guys, I just try to tell guys, around this time is all about just you. You focus on your game. Not really worry about your opponents, not worry about how's the season going to play out. Just really focus on your game, your technique, and finding ways to get better. And also getting those mental reps from just standing on the side watching vets and guys in front of you.
Morgan Burnett talking like the vet that he is. Now, you're part of a defense that's got a lot of talent, but when you look at that offense and you look at a group that's got Baker Mayfield at quarterback, and then you've got some weapons which include Odell Beckham Jr. and Jarvis Landry, as a safety, when you see that, how scary is it?
As a defensive player, I don't think too many guys want to call it scary, but you know that's a lot of talent, a lot of playmaking ability on that side. And for us, you know, we're just glad that we're on the same team, because we know that those guys are going to prepare us on the defensive side by bringing high competition, high energy, and getting us ready and making us better for the upcoming regular season.
Now, going to Cleveland is also a reunion for you with secondary coach Joe Witt Jr., who you worked with in Green Bay. That's another one of those guys you knew before. What was he like to work with and play for?
Oh, no, he was a lot of fun, because in Green Bay it was Joe Witt and Darren Perry, and those guys have a lot of knowledge about the game, very smart coaches, very great teachers, and those type of guys that with the energy that they bring, you as a player don't want to let them down, because you know they're going to have your back 100%, and you want to go out there and prove those guys right. So, I mean, it's a lot of fun to work for a guy like Joe Witt, and we're looking forward to this season.
Morgan Burnett joining me for another moment or two. Now, you're a proud member of the Georgia Tech family. We talked about that. When I was in Atlanta for the Super Bowl, I had a chance to sit down with the new head coach there, Jeff Collins. I was really impressed with him, but I'm not sure what was more impressive, his love of football or his love of Waffle House. Where do you come out on Waffle House?
Yeah, especially if you're down in Atlanta, Waffle House is definitely a staple. Especially going there and order your All-Star special at any time of the day, whether you like breakfast in the morning, at lunch, or for dinner. Waffle House is a place to go.
There you go. Now, my man Jeff Collins, yeah, a lot of energy. I really liked his vibe. What's your sense of the vibe with him in that program right now? Is he the right guy at the right time?
Oh, he's definitely the right guy. Like you said, I love his energy. I love the way he's connecting just with the culture in Atlanta, with the whole 404 movement, with the whole Waffle House movement. I mean, he has the guys and gadgets of the screen. We had Young Jeezy at practice. I mean, the energy is great. I went out to the spring game, and the crowd, the turnout was big. We had a lot of former players back. And, man, the hype is real over at Georgia Tech, and we're all excited.
So one last thought. When you talk about the former players, Collins, he actually has a long history with Georgia Tech. It includes playing a role in helping to assemble that famous recruiting class, which included you, Jonathan Dwyer, and Derek Morgan. What do you remember about him from back then?
Yeah, just the same. Just the same type of energy he brings now. But he brings it, and he brings that family-oriented atmosphere to the program. And that's what I remember about just getting recruited by Georgia Tech. And that's one of the main reasons why I signed to Georgia Tech. And just the same guys that I came in with, we still have that tight bond. And now with Jeff Collins there, I'm talking about it's an open door policy. I mean, you literally can just walk up to campus and walk right in his office, and it's an open door. And that's what you appreciate. And us being able to been in the league and seeing things throughout the league, we're able to go back and spread that knowledge to the guys that's coming up now.
He's not looking to get run. He's looking to get in the big dance. Jeff in SoCal. What's going on, Jeff?
Rome, you hit the nail on the head with the hammer, my dude. Hey, what a truly iconic call by Nooch yesterday. Apparently my comment about Brad infringed on a obscure reference left dropped in 2015. Nooch, you're coming very close to Stephen H. Towns' brand, my dude. What's next? You going to start a fan site called StuckNooch.com? I'm not sure if Nooch was genuinely mad about the skinny smack or if he was just hangry, Rome. I mean, by the time you went to him, he was probably dehydrated and exhausted from having to hold the phone to his ear for 30 minutes. Hey, Nooch, is today recovery day, buddy? Jim, I am sad I missed him while he was out here, though. Him and Beaks cruising around Laguna Beach like the modern-day Chris Farley and David Spade. I bet that was a sight to see. Anyways, Jim, quick poll question. Who's more exhausting, New York fans reacting to the NBA lottery or Sonia Curry performing for the camera every time one of her sons did something last night? And finally, Jim, I do want you to know I'm coming for a golden ticket. The 25th smack-off deserves better than the group of kooks who currently hold them. I mean, the biggest beef going into the smack-off right now is Rick and Buffalo versus fictional betting odds on a website by a guy with a hobby and a little bit too much free time. If you ask me, Jim, Rick should be the favorite. My only concern is if he wins that 5K, he would nearly double his yearly salary, and that kind of money can be dangerous. Jim, I'm like the nerdy chick in every 80s movie, so let me take off my thick frame glasses, let my hair down, so you can see I'm the smoke show you're in love with the entire time. I'm right here, buddy. In the words of John Manziel, hurry up and draft me, Romy. Let's rack this smack off together. Outro.
Rack him. Jeff in SoCal. Was that so hard, Jeff? Was that so hard? You spent your entire life and jungle career getting run. And then you finally kind of grow up and mature and evolve and decide, you know, I think I want that $5,000. I think I want that $5,000, and I think I want to win the most important event ever. Let's go to Parody Larry. He's in the Bay Area. Lawrence, you literally cut the line right to the front, Larry. What's up?
That's unbelievable. Hey, Jim, listen, I know personal appearance smack is not Joe fodder, but it seems your show has been dominated for the last week by a certain cholesterol-y challenged clone in Studio City. So, Mr. Beaks, this one's for you. Oh, I'm going to hit the buffet tonight. Come on, I promise I won't bite. Then I'll scope from the hot tub all night. Fat bottom beats, you make that fat alarm go off. War beat.
Ah. That's not a good call. No.
You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
No, you got to run that back. I think that we did him wrong. I would not have run him for that. No, I think you got to give this guy, you got to put some respect on that. So when he went to his chorus and got to Fat Bottom Beaks.
Good night.